Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine has now passed the 3.5-year mark, and there's still no end in sight. The most recent push to negotiate a ceasefire, led by the United States, ground to a halt in early September after Vladimir Putin suggested that Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky meet with him in Moscow. Zelensky rejected the invitation as a sign that Putin actually has no desire to negotiate, and he later said in an interview that the Russian president is, quote, playing games with the United States. Meanwhile, on the battlefield in Ukraine, Russian troops are continuing their offensive in central Donbas. And while Ukrainian forces have succeeded in slowing their advance, this has come at the cost of Kyiv's defenses elsewhere, creating vulnerable gaps between frontline positions that Russian forces can slip through. With the frontline becoming increasingly fluid, peace talks stalled, and the Russian military launching deadly missile and drone attacks on Ukraine's cities and energy grid ahead of the cold winter months, Russia's war against Ukraine is showing no signs of stopping. But what will its next chapter look like? That's the subject of today's show. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. Hello, you're listening to the Naked Pravda, Medusa's English language podcast. I'm Eilish Hart, your host for this episode and the editor of The Beat, our long reads newsletter covering Central and Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Central Asia. For today's episode, I'm joined by Maria Snegovaya, a senior fellow in the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Together with her co-author, Max Bergman, the director of the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at CSIS, Maria recently published a report analyzing the mounting costs of Russia's war effort and potential scenarios for the war's future trajectory. And she was kind enough to come on the show to talk through their analysis with me. We cover a lot of ground in this interview, so let's get into it. Russia's full-scale war against Ukraine has now dragged on for more than 3.5 years, and Western diplomatic efforts to push the Kremlin towards a ceasefire have stalled. That's my very brief summary of where we are right now, but how would you describe the current situation on the front line and on the diplomatic front?
It's been 3.5 years of this very bloody war of attrition. The war is the bloodiest in Europe since the end of the Second World War. It has led to tremendous cost on both sides, Ukraine and Russia. It is an unprovoked war of aggression from Russia. And unfortunately, there is no end in sight. We see that after some original breakthrough in early 2022 and then being pushed back by the Ukrainian army, basically Russia adjusted to this war of attrition, as has seen from economic perspective, as has seen from the military perspective, that they adjusted their mobilization mechanisms and has been pushing very gradually further into Ukraine for the remaining of time. So as of now, Russia progressing very, very slowly into Ukraine, losing a lot of people per every square kilometer. I think the data here shows that it's about 100 to 150 troops per each square kilometer, which is a horrendous number, really indeed the highest among most of the wars that Russia has fought. But nonetheless, the political decision, the political logic in Russia is such that it keeps pushing further, hoping that eventually Ukraine defenses will collapse. As of now, Russia occupies approximately 20% of Ukrainian territory, and it appears that its originally announced goals, that is occupation of the rest of the Donetsk region, Luhansk region, with some question mark about the other remaining regions like Zaporizhia and Kherson, they have remained more or less unchanged. And perhaps even more important that Vladimir Putin, in his public statements, keep referencing the original problems, the origins of the conflict, when he is asked about whether he's willing to negotiate a ceasefire, a peace with Ukraine. That means that, unfortunately, Putin remains quite committed in his decision to basically revise international security, to limit Ukraine's sovereignty, quote-unquote, denazify, demilitarize Ukraine, basically all of the announced goals. That is our key premise. The original goals that the Kremlin postulated at the start of this war have remained largely unchanged. And that means, unfortunately, that the war will not end anytime soon.
In your report, you write that despite the mounting economic costs of the war and these heavy military casualties that you were referring to, Russia continues to believe that it's winning the war of attrition. What sustains that belief?
Well, first of all, the Russian political system, Russian power circles are not, unfortunately, known to adjust their priors. And if they were able to do that, maybe the war of 2022 would have never started, because already 2014, Russian aggression against Ukraine has demonstrated how biased and misguided some of the Kremlin beliefs about Ukraine were, right? The Ukrainians were not eager, in most regions were not welcoming Russian army, and even at the time, the Kremlin faced a lot of issues inflaming many of the regions along the eastern southern Ukrainian areas as it intended. You'd think that after that original failure to achieve the goal of trying to subjugate Ukraine, trying to pull Ukraine back into Russia's spheres of interest, there will be some reconsideration taking place in the Kremlin circles. In fact, instead, what we've seen in 2022 is that the Kremlin doubled down on the same goals, this time implementing a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, seemingly anticipating that the Russian army will be welcomed by Ukrainians. You know, notoriously, they had this parade suits carried with them that they were planning to wear if they successfully occupied Ukraine within early weeks. None of that obviously happened, but even that did not alter the strategic logic of Moscow. It did alter the tactical approach that Moscow used, and indeed, there were a lot of revisions made in the Kremlin planning in order to make this war more sustainable. It was not originally sustainable, for example, with the original side of the troops, of the army, and the economic model. But the strategic goals have remained the same, and more or less the same dynamic has unraveled ever since. Unfortunately, it seems that the Kremlin leadership, as the current state of mind, is unable to radically alter its worldviews, its approaches, unless they face some really radical consequences, and just unable to continue. And that, as we argue in our report, has not happened yet. I will also flag that the Russian leadership, unfortunately, has inherited much of the Soviet outlook at the world, conditioned by this perception of the spheres of interest, inherent antagonism with the West, Russia's claim to really significant parts of Europe, and veto, or at least a very significant Russian role in the European security architecture that Russia believes it has a claim to, which is often not in congruence with the actual power that Russia possesses. So this war essentially is an effort on the Russian side to basically reclaim at least parts of its might that, in its view, unjustly lost as in result of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Hope is that the Kremlin will be proven wrong in this endeavor, but that is yet to happen.
In terms of the practical side of this, how long can Russia realistically afford to continue the war at its current pace if it's not going to revise this overarching strategic objective?
In this brief, we are trying to address this particular question based on our previous analysis of Russia's economic, social, demographic, and military industrial dimensions. And unfortunately, even if the situation in Russia certainly is not getting any better, over the last 3.5 years, a lot of resources have been wasted on this war of attrition. Russia has been borrowing very actively from its own future in order to invest in the war. But nonetheless, the resources are still basically there to sustain the war for at least 2-3 years unless things change quite dramatically. Well, specifically, we're looking at the economic dimension and showing that while indeed the economic growth that the Kremlin-induced spending on military-industrial complex has been able to sustain in the first couple of years of the war is now basically gone, and we're likely to see stagnation or even recession in Russian economy. Nonetheless, the resources are still there to just keep issuing more tanks, missiles, drones, and inflict significant damage on Ukraine, especially given that much of the Kremlin strategy relies on these drones attacks on Ukraine, and the Kremlin has really boosted its drone production. It's a relatively cheap production, but some analysts forecast that at some point the Kremlin will be able to send to Ukraine about 2,000 drones in one salvo. Right now it's sending already about 500, 600, which is a significant increase from the past. So that's relatively easy and cheap. And so far, Russia has the resources as long as sanctions are relatively weak. Russia is circumventing them and continues to accumulate significant resources from selling its energy. Second dimension is the social dimension. Unfortunately, the Russian public continues to demonstrate resilience and acquiescence to this horrible war, despite tremendous accumulating costs, right now nearing about 1 million casualties, and significant economic costs that have been inflicted on Russia. The only notable shift in the Russian public opinion that we are able to trace is the growing support for peace talks, which by late August 2025 has reached about two-thirds of the Russian respondents being surveyed in multiple surveys. However, there's a caveat there. These groups would like just to freeze the war as is while maintaining the occupied territories without necessarily any concessions, and that is unlikely to be acceptable for the Ukrainian side. There are potential fracture points going forward, and I would flag that when the Russian public starts feeling the cost of the war on the personal level, you know, be it, for example, drones attacks, attacks on the refineries that convert into higher gasoline prices or gasoline shortages, or maybe more direct link between the sanctions, the war, the economic cost, then they actually become way more skeptical about the war. And in some ways, that's exactly what we've seen at the late Soviet period, when the Afghanistan war has become very unpopular in combination with a major economic crisis. However, while certainly things do not look great for Russia, we are far from a serious economic crisis as of now. So that means that, unfortunately, the public opinion probably will continue to be acquiescing with this war, especially given the intensified repression domestically in Russia and the crackdown on independent media resources that allow the Kremlin to control the propaganda coverage of this war. There is a demographic dimension. The Kremlin, as I mentioned before, has shifted to this model of recruitment of the new so-called volunteers to the war, offering them very, very generous bonuses, which in some instances allow people to purchase apartments even in their own regions, and maintaining more or less a sustained rate of 30,000-40,000 so-called volunteers per month, which is approximately as many people as the Kremlin loses on the battlefield given this enormous rate of attrition. This makes the war sustainable for the Kremlin given that it more or less replenishes as many as it loses on the battlefield. The question is, how long is it able to continue? Indeed, the general price tag per volunteer has been increasing. That made some analysts suggest that it's actually becoming more difficult for the Kremlin to attract additional volunteers, and hence it has to increase the price tag. Nonetheless, so far, since the Kremlin shifted to this model, it's been able to sustain this recruitment, and it still has reserves based on most existing literature. And given this distribution of resources in Russia, where huge demand for labor is concentrated in big cities, but there are many rural areas with relatively high unemployment where people are actually looking for ways to make money and potentially are available for further recruitment. At least as of now, there's not enough evidence to say that the Kremlin has run out fully out of that reserve. And last but not the least, the military-industrial complex. There's a lot of information showing that the Kremlin may be running out of its Soviet stocks, on which it relied for quite some time at the start of the war, including tanks, most importantly. Having said that, it's also important to keep in mind that a lot of investment has been sent directly into rebuilding Russia's military-industrial complex. So the Kremlin is still producing relatively substantive number of missiles and, most importantly, drones that I already covered to continue inflict this damage on Ukraine. And because the war basically is shifting where we do not really see the Kremlin very actively relying on the tanks, drones are really changing the situation. Again, even with Soviet stockpiles being eroded, the Kremlin maintains the ability to inflict significant damage on Ukraine, at least through these horrible, atrocious strikes against its civil population and for other means, using additional resources and rebuilding its military-industrial complex. So from all of these domains, areas perspective, you'll see that, unfortunately, the Kremlin has resources, and given that the original goals seem to have remained unchanged, it means that it will probably keep pushing, trying to achieve its advantage and its original goals in Ukraine.
Is there any reason to believe that Putin has a particular pain or risk threshold when it comes to this war?
We have seen that on a number of occasions, especially when the Kremlin was losing on the battlefield, like in the fall 2022, the risks, for example, of nuclear escalation were rising. And it seems that, for example, at that time, China's role has become very instrumental. China is the number one, at least one of the key crucial factors enabling the Kremlin to sustain this war. China has helped the Kremlin substitute for many articles and goods and dual-use components that would have otherwise not been available given the Western sanctions. And China is basically the Kremlin's main ally now that the Kremlin is de facto facing isolation from the West. So the Chinese role and influence is absolutely crucial. And it seems that there are thresholds that China can emphasize, like possible threats of nuclear escalation, that limit Putin's willingness to push forward. That's one point. Second, Russia very much remains petrostate. And even if the macroeconomic authorities have tried to diversify the budget away from the energy dependence, and the share of the energy revenues has been shrinking from 50% at the start of the war to now 30%, nonetheless, it's still major dependence. And even if it's only 30%, remember that the other parts that are being increased as a source of the revenues are, for example, taxes, that in turn are at least partly conditioned by energy revenues. So this is where, of course, the Kremlin's Achilles heel is. And the effort to perhaps more effectively target the Kremlin's energy revenues without destabilizing the energy markets globally appears to be on the agenda of the Trump administration now that Trump's effort to negotiate the ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia seems to have stalled. So certainly that is potentially a risk for the Kremlin. It seems to be understood by the Russian macroeconomic authorities. And I will flag that in the past, major economic financial crises in Russia tended to coincide with a radical collapse in the price of oil. So that remains a very visible point of weakness for Russia. And of course, last but not the least, Ukraine deserves a lot of credit for its morale, for its resistance, for its creativity, for its highly successful attacks on Russian refineries and ability to identify Russia's weak points more than once. We have seen Ukraine during this war leveraging its perhaps suboptimal positions in a way that was completely unanticipated by most analysts and the Kremlin, most importantly, and being able to deliver a major blow to the Kremlin. So Ukraine, just being this very experienced fighter against the Kremlin, certainly deserves enormous credit, and I'm sure that more is to come from Ukraine.
With all of this context laid out and keeping it in mind, your report outlines four scenarios for the trajectory of the war that you see as the most plausible. So I'd like to talk through each one and what it would mean for Russia and for Ukraine. Scenario one is a Russian breakthrough and the collapse of the Ukrainian military. What would bring about this situation and how likely is it in your view?
This scenario, perhaps one that became more likely at the start of the second term of Trump administration, when the talk was widespread about how all the aid, lethal support for Ukraine was going to be cut off or perhaps pushed towards European allies. And indeed, under this scenario, if Western support is drastically reduced, that would give Russia an advantage that can be reinforced if Ukraine's air defenses falter, if the European unity is undermined by example for the rise of the populist actors across Europe that are unwilling to provide additional support for Ukraine. The Kremlin certainly actively is betting on this scenario, hoping to exhaust Ukraine, cause a frontline collapse, and eventually achieve capitulation of Ukraine. However, that would require a significant weakening of Ukraine's forces. That's unlikely to happen overnight. And also probably necessitates some strategic miscalculations on the Western part. And while we did see certainly some elements of the transatlantic alliance weakening, overall it appears that partly with significant intensification of the European allies' pressure on the U.S. administration, nonetheless, so far it has been able to survive. More importantly, European countries seem to have realized that the war represents an existential risk, not just for Ukraine, but for the EU, the European security as we know it more broadly. And accordingly, that scenario is not very likely, seemingly, at this particular moment. But the Kremlin continues certainly betting on it, hence the continuing push and pressure on Ukraine and the West more broadly.
So scenario two is a prolonged low-intensity conflict, otherwise known as the forever war option. How would this differ from the current state of the conflict?
So this is actually perhaps one of the most likely scenarios that, in our opinion, is not sufficiently talked about, right? Especially against this backdrop of the effort to achieve a ceasefire with Russia. It's less understood that this is perhaps something that's awaiting all of us in the near future. This dynamic is similar to what we currently see, except that it presumes more serious stabilization of the front that we currently see. I have mentioned that Russia keeps pushing forward at very incremental rates. It hasn't been even able to achieve the original goal of occupying the rest of the Donetsk region to date, and it has about 25-30% of the region still to go. Nonetheless, it's still pushing forward. The low-intensity forever war that we are describing in our second scenario presumes more or less stabilization of the front, and much of the action continues through artillery shelling, drone warfare, and deep strikes without decisive offensives. Russia right now, as we know, is still implementing an offensive, trying to achieve significant breakthrough into Ukrainian territory. But under scenario two, probably Russia realizes that it's unable to achieve major breakthrough and switches to basically the method of terrorizing Ukraine through airstrikes primarily. And the goal here is that while Russia has to come to terms with the fact that it's unable to achieve its territorial goals in Ukraine, at the very least, the longer-term goal of preventing Ukraine from joining the EU, NATO, to transform it into so-called limbo state, suspended state, with weakened economy and undermined Western resolve to support Ukraine without any possibility for Ukraine to attract foreign direct investment, etc., etc., that's essentially the vision here. And unfortunately, that is still likely and relatively cheap for the Kremlin to achieve, because if it's visibly struggling to achieve any major territorial breakthroughs, but consistent airstrikes are very much achievable, especially given the current drone productions. They're cheap, there is no evident defense against them at the moment, and unfortunately, this is something to keep in mind for Ukraine futures, and something, as we argue, that the European and Western allies more broadly should factor in when developing their plans to support Ukraine.
Yeah, in the report, you call scenario two the next best option for Putin after an outright victory. And I guess, you know, the last two scenarios are the least good options from Putin's view. So scenario three is that Moscow agrees to a ceasefire. Why might Russia decide it wants to stop fighting?
Both scenario three and scenario four, the peace settlement and somewhat of a more or less lasting peace, they presume a significantly intensified pressure on Russia and some sort of change in Russia domestically, primarily perhaps economic change through some sort of crisis that would undermine the Russian morale and essentially exposes to the elites, the society, and even Putin himself, the inability to achieve a major breakthrough against the intensifying domestic cost. Right now, one of the reasons why the Kremlin is able to keep pushing forward is that it's not facing significant domestic resistance. The society is accepting this reality. The elites are acquiescing. In fact, they deliberately made beneficiaries of this new status quo for distribution of the assets and whatnot. The ability to push the Kremlin towards the ceasefire will only be achieved if there is significant increase of the costs for the Kremlin to continue this war. That will require, as we argue, for Kyiv to escalate, to de-escalate. That can involve Kyiv's drone strikes, intensified strikes maybe on the Russian refineries. We can think about maybe long-range missile strikes into Russia, really serious toughening of sanctions that would lead to radical decline in the economic revenues and forcing the Kremlin to make some serious trade-offs at the expense of maybe some of increase of the salaries or spending for its key constituencies, etc., etc. We argue, though, that the strategy relies on the assumption that Russian morale is fragile. But unfortunately, we tend to usually underestimate Russian resilience analytically, and we are not very clear about especially how to get to that particular destination. But one thing is certain, the pressure should be increased on the Kremlin quite significantly, and the war, its cost should be felt domestically by the Russians for the possibility of ceasefire to be increased.
The fourth scenario would be a full-blown peace agreement. And you write in the report that this seems like the least likely scenario because it would require a major crisis inside Russia,
yes.
Not just, you know, a crisis at the front in Ukraine. Can you unpack for me what you mean by a major crisis inside Russia?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here again, this is a scenario-based approach, and I will flag that, unfortunately, we are nowhere near the end of this war. But this dynamic is broadly modeled after other periods when Russia fought unsuccessful wars, usually those preceding some revolutions or collapse or radical weakening of the existing regimes, whether you look at the 19th century, early 20th century, or the late Soviet Union period. In all of those instances, the economic shock was so pronounced and so deep that Russia just basically had no resources anymore to sustain the war, and domestic turmoil and public dissatisfaction eventually turned at the regime, forcing it to basically accept major concessions in the ongoing war. So something like that is anticipated under the scenario, given that, as we have discussed at the start of this conversation, the Kremlin shows no sign of having altered its original goals in Ukraine or vis-a-vis their ambitious goal of revising the international security as we know it more broadly. So it's important to keep in mind that we are dealing with a very aggressive regime that is not driven by pure rational logic, right? For example, it's currently sacrificing Russia's futures for the sake of this war, very unsuccessful for the Kremlin, without very clear tangible outcome. But nonetheless, given the nature of the Russian leadership, we're looking at some major blow for Russia, for this current dynamic to be radically altered in favor of Ukraine. And of course, it's important to also keep in mind that many of Russia/Soviet wars ended with the natural passing of the aggressive, assertive leadership that started the war in the first place, like, for example, Korean War in case of Stalin. So one of the possibilities for this scenario will certainly be enhanced with a rotation on the leadership, probably at this point with this natural passing of Vladimir Putin.
Okay, so having talked through all of these potential scenarios, what can Ukraine and its Western allies do to try and tip the balance in Kyiv's favor and or to end the fighting?
So in all of our scenarios, as I have discussed, the more favorable options for Ukraine and the West more broadly is achieved through significantly intensified pressure on Russia. And that certainly includes developing much more robust, enforced, agreed upon sanctions design across the allies of Ukraine. But in addition to that, certainly sustaining significant investment in European and Ukrainian defense industries in order to maintain Ukraine's frontline forces. There are a lot of ways in which this may be achieved. Europe already is doing a lot, certainly compared to the pre-2022 period, in terms of boosting its military industrial defense base. But unfortunately, it's nowhere near what is needed at this current point in order to significantly alter the Kremlin's calculus. Suffice it to point, for example, that the combined production of artillery shells by the US and Europe is below what Russia is producing. And also on top of that, Russia is getting additional supplies from North Korea and elsewhere. So accordingly, given this current dynamic, you should not be wondering as to why the Kremlin seems so motivated to keep pushing. Once Europe achieves a sustainable level of support for Ukraine, and by the way, Ukraine has pioneered multiple technologies, including drones, of course, which can also be used to train European troops in order to boost their own technological competence and the new preparedness to the new warfare. That, of course, will undermine the Kremlin resolve because it will expose that basically no amount of effort on the Kremlin side is likely to undermine Ukrainian defenses. But we are not there yet. And while the West definitely deserves a lot of credit for supporting Ukraine, a lot remains to be done. And most importantly, it should be done faster, just because the Kremlin feels the time is on its side and the Western unity will fracture eventually if it keeps pushing. So it's in our hands to basically successfully prove Kremlin wrong.